answered. But ignoring Haig was easier said than done.
He wants to show this to his boss and to his boss's boss, Bradley said.
No one needed to explain to Harlfinger that Haig's boss's boss just happened to be the new president of the United States. Harlfinger had played enough politics over the years to know when it was time to concede.
Okay, he relented.
The photographs could be left with Haig, but only for 24 hours. That was time enough for Haig to bring the material to Kissinger. Later, it would be Kissinger who made the presentation to Nixon. Nixon was fascinated, so much so that word got back to the CIA. While the agency's analysts had long been interested in what the regular spy subs managed to pick up, it had generally left control of the operations to the Navy. But now, the CIA and its director, Richard Helms, were suddenly and intensely interested in the ocean deep. Helms began to engineer a takeover, CIA style. First, he created a new level of bureaucracy, a liaison agency that would supposedly pool the resources of naval intelligence and the CIA. It would be called the National Underwater Reconnaissance Office, NURO. This wasn't the first time the CIA had made this kind of arrangement. In 1961, the agency decided to share control over the satellite operations with the Air Force by creating a joint venture dubbed the National Reconnaissance Office. NURO was supposed to be divided evenly between Navy and CIA staffers. At its top ranks, it was. Its director was John Warner, Nixon's new Secretary of the Navy. Bradley would be staff director. Heading up the CIA end was Carl Duckett, its deputy director for science and technology. But from the day NURO was formed, the CIA took charge. Bradley could spare only a few people for the new office. His entire staff in the undersea part of naval intelligence numbered only about a dozen. The CIA, however, had no such constraints. It moved in with 8 permanent staffers and more consultants loyal to the agency. Worse, it was becoming increasingly clear to Bradley and Craven that the CIA couldn't tell a submarine from an underwater mountain. By now, the two men had come up with a plan for retrieving the best of what was on board the Soviet Gulf. Their idea was to eventually send mini-subs to grab a nuclear warhead, the safe containing the Soviets' crypto codes, and the submarine's burst transmitters and receivers, so that the Navy could finally decode all of the message traffic it had been collecting. The two men had already proven that the Gulf's hull could be opened without destroying everything inside. They had borrowed Army demolition experts to test their theory. With a large steel plate shielding various fragile and flammable objects set up in a pool of water, plastic explosives were affixed to a tiny area and detonated. The blast left a small doorway, barely singeing the articles behind the steel. That's really all anyone needed to do, open a small doorway and reach in. The rest of the Gulf could be left buried at sea. The military had watched these submarines being built in overhead photography for 10 years. Naval intelligence knew the Gulf, too, down to nearly every nut and bolt. The rockets that the Gulfs used to launch their nuclear payloads were primitive, with ranges of only 750 miles. Both the United States and the Soviet Union had already engineered rockets with 1,500-mile ranges. There was little to be gained in attempting the impossible job of pulling up thousands of tons of already antiquated gear from the bottom of the ocean. Besides, it would take years to develop the equipment for such a salvage attempt. Carl Duckett and his CIA loyalists listened politely to the more abbreviated plan. But when they came back with their answer, Craven and Bradley were dumbstruck. The CIA recommended picking up the whole submarine and intended to build a massive crane-laden ship to reach down
and grab the Gulf. Craven and Bradley couldn't believe it. The Gulf may have hit bottom at 100 knots or more, accelerating 70 feet per second as it fell. It may have looked intact, but it was probably as fragile as a sandcastle. Touch it hard enough, and it would disintegrate.
"You can't pick up the goddamn submarine, or it will fall apart," Bradley blurted out.
"Oh, no, Jesus Christ Almighty. You people are in a tank. That's a pipe dream."
Bradley may have been right, but the CIA held the power in Washington and usually got what it wanted, even when what it wanted was, in Harlfinger's opinion, crazy and impossible. Former CIA Director Richard M. Helms says now that he never even heard of the alternative that Bradley and Craven had proposed. The CIA, however, wasn't alone in its enthusiasm. Chief of Naval Operations Thomas H. Moorer loved big, fascinating technological projects and was captivated by the CIA plan. Here was a chance to snatch a whole submarine and get back at the Soviets for North Korea's capture of Pueblo. Besides, he wasn't convinced that Bradley and Craven's method could recover all of the key gear on the Gulf. In the end, Defense Secretary Melvin R. Laird gave the final approval to the CIA plan, acknowledging that he did so despite the fact that some people thought it was a nutty idea. Laird rationalized the exercise. Creating a ship to lift the Gulf from the Pacific might also give the United States the ability to retrieve its own submarines if they were lost. Laird consulted Howard Hughes, the billionaire recluse whose shipping company was hired by the CIA to build the ship that would try to hoist the Gulf from the ocean floor. The ship would be called the Glomar Explorer, and the effort codenamed Project Jennifer. Craven watched these wranglings, no longer surprised by a national intelligence program run by politics. He may have been cynical, but he was certain that the CIA was looking for a project that would funnel hundreds of millions of dollars to Hughes to pay off Nixon's heavy political debts. Whatever the reason, Nixon quickly approved the CIA plan, and Bradley and Craven were left to whisper their dissent to themselves and to one another. No one else, it seemed, cared to listen. If anything, Craven was rewarded for his protest by being shut out of the operation. The largest deep-water undertaking ever was going to go forward without the guidance of the men who had made it possible. It would also go forward without Halibut's Commander Moore. It was time for Rickover to make his move, to crack down on this world that had tried to exclude him. The Admiral had stood by when Moore's predecessor claimed higher authority for Halibut than Rickover's Naval Reactors branch. Rickover had observed tens of millions being poured into Halibut, while he himself came under fire when NR1's $30 million budget ballooned to $90 million. He had bided his time while Nixon awarded Halibut the Presidential Unit Citation, PUC, the highest submarine award possible. And he was unmoved when Moore won the Distinguished Service Medal for finding the Gulf. All the while, Rickover's reactor specialists at the shipyard were focused on Halibut. Her men became so agitated under the constant scrutiny that Moore suspected they were making mistakes just to give Rickover's men something to mark down, just enough so that the men would be satisfied and leave. Crew members weren't admitting as much, but Moore knew the tension was getting to them, just as he knew that it was only a matter of time until Rickover had the ammunition he was looking for. He was going to send a fleet-shaking salvo that no submarine, no matter its mission or its accomplishments, was beyond his reach or the reach of his safety inspectors. He got his opening early one morning in 1969. Halibut had been moved to the Mare Island Naval Shipyard, just out of San Francisco. Her reactor was being refueled while her officers were distracted by yet another refit designed to enhance Halibut's deep-sea capabilities. Rickover was scheduled to come to the sub that day, only nobody on board knew when. Moore was back at his shore quarters, 6 blocks away from Halibut's dock, when the Admiral arrived at Mare Island, dressed, as usual, in civilian clothes. Rickover first encountered a pair of Marine guards who refused to let him pass the gate. That wouldn't have been too much of a problem. These men might not have recognized Rickover in person, but they would have known his name. All he had to do was show his identification, and that he refused to do. He was infuriated that anyone at a sub-base could fail to recognize him on sight. He crashed the gate. Later, Moore would hear that the Admiral raced down the causeway on foot, guards in chase. He was caught and again asked to show his identification. By the time the guards had been satisfied, Rickover stormed straight to the office of Robert Metzger, his reactor safety chief on Mare Island. Still infuriated, Rickover decided not to go to Halibut himself. Instead, he sent a representative, one of the men who had traveled with him from D.C. In doing so, Rickover set the stage for history to repeat itself. Just about anyone on the sub would have recognized Rickover immediately, and no one would have questioned him. Nobody, however, knew his representative, so the young submariner serving topside watch did what he was supposed to do. He approached the man and asked for identification, then called down to the duty officer, who ended up denying Rickover's man access. When Moore heard about all of this, he immediately sought out Rickover. The Admiral didn't give him much chance to smooth things over. Instead, he barked, "Moore, you ought to worry about your career." Then he demanded, "And what are you going to do to the duty officer who denied us access?" Rickover never did bother to inspect Halibut, but the sub would feel his wrath. The constant review of Halibut's reactor operations continued. Halibut's crew knew there was enough to find if you noted every small move, a wrong wrench used, a failure to exactly follow procedures, and more. Moore was removed from command of Halibut 3 months after his run-in with Rickover. Although the move was wrapped in the paper of a usual transfer, few people doubted that Rickover was behind it. That, to me, was one of the numerous irrational personnel actions that the gentleman was capable of doing, and did do, says Rear Admiral Walter L. Small, Jr., then commander of submarines in the Pacific. Rickover was going to dismiss anyone he wanted to dismiss, whether he had the authority or not. Much of Moore's wardroom chose to resign from the Navy, some in silent protest over Rickover's treatment of their captain, others simply to avoid the endless barrage. Even Doc Wheat, the corpsman who had poured the brandy that revived Charlie Hammonds, had come under fire when Rickover's crew deemed that the records of the crew's radiation exposures were a mess. Moore was moved to the Pentagon to work with the Deep Submergence Group, and, ironically, ended up being part of the team seeking missions for Rickover's beloved NR-1. Rickover had engineered Moore's firing, but he hadn't gotten rid of him. And despite Rickover's ire, Moore made full captain along with the rest of his class. He had too many favorable fitness reports, had accomplished too much for anyone to deny him, even Rickover. But full captain or not, Moore had lost his boat. It was a bizarre reward. After leading the Navy's boldest undersea spy program, Moore would never command at sea again. Chapter 5. Death of a Submarine. It was May 27, 1968, and the end of a long day. John Craven was driving along the Potomac on his way home when the news came over the radio. The USS Scorpion, SSN 589, was missing. 99 men were missing. Barely 2 months had passed since U.S. intelligence had realized the Soviets had lost their Gulf submarine, and Craven was still helping Bradley figure out where it had gone down when this latest news came. Craven listened hard for details about Scorpion, but there weren't any. Nobody had any idea where Scorpion was or what had happened to her. All they knew was that the 3,500-ton nuclear attack submarine was due back in Norfolk, Virginia, and had failed to arrive. She hadn't been slinking off Soviet shores or even plumbing new depths, as the USS Thresher had been doing when she was lost 5 years earlier. Scorpion had simply been cruising through the Atlantic Ocean on a straight track for home. Just like the World War II submarine she was named for, Scorpion had vanished without a trace, and seemingly without reason. Craven slowed his car at the next exit and turned for the Pentagon. As Craven stepped into the controlled pandemonium of the war room, all he knew was that as the Navy's top deep water scientist, he would be needed. A submarine was missing. 99 men were missing. Surveying the crowd of captains and admirals and other officers already there, Craven sensed something he had never encountered in a room full of top-ranking military men. Abject fear. The fear could be seen in the tensed faces of the men who stood scrutinizing a huge wall chart mapping Scorpion's assigned track, and it could be heard in the shaken tones of others who were intently studying navigational charts strewn all over the room. Men were laying out hypotheses and search patterns. They were plotting Scorpion's track, creating a path for search planes above, and looking for the sparse undersea mountains below. Just a few months before, the USS Scamp, SSN 588, was nearly lost when she rammed into an undersea mountain in the Pacific in her race to go monitor a Soviet missile test. A similar accident, and Scorpion might be lost forever. Then again, those mountains might also be the only places along her path where she and her crew could have sunk without meeting instant crushing death. Other officers were studying the positions of nearby Soviet ships and submarines, wondering whether any had crossed Scorpion's path. People all over the room were trying to weigh the possibilities, wanting to believe that Scorpion was still intact, her crew stranded, but alive. "What can my organization do to help?" Craven said over the worried voices, the roar of competing conversations, and the rustle of the charts. Nobody looked up, or even seemed to notice him speaking from the doorway. Most of these officers knew nothing of Halibut, of Craven's role in preparing her for deep-sea searches, or even of his success in pinpointing the atomic bomb the Air Force lost in the deep Atlantic near Palomares, Spain. To most of the rank and file here, Craven was just another skinny engineer. Those few who did know him well found him to be a man full of odd ideas and strange search methods that didn't sound like anything ever penned in a Navy manual. Few of the officers in the war room that day would have believed that Craven might be their best and perhaps only chance of finding Scorpion. Craven repeated his question. This time, someone answered.
"We haven't been able to find Scorpion on the acoustic nets. We don't know where it is. If there's anything you can do with respect to that, do it."
With that, Craven was left on his own, left to try to figure out why and where Scorpion had vanished. Odds were worse than 1,000,000 to 1 against anyone finding the boat. She could have been anywhere on a track that covered 3,000 miles of the Atlantic. The families of the Scorpion crew had begun to worry as early as February 15, 1968, 3 months before Craven heard the news on the radio, 3 months before rumors began swirling through the sub-force that the Soviets might have sunk her. There, standing on the dock, tossing the final mooring line to the crew as Scorpion departed, was Dan Rogers, an electrician's mate, who had risked his career by demanding to be transferred off the boat. Writing to his captain, Lieutenant Commander Francis A. Slattery, that everyone on board was in danger. The Navy had always portrayed the 252-foot-long sub as a gleaming showpiece, but Rogers said Scorpion was so overdue for a thorough overhaul that the crew had taken to calling her the USS Scrap Iron. There were oil leaks in the hydraulic systems and seawater seeping in through the propeller shaft seals. Her emergency ballast systems weren't working, and the Navy had restricted her depth to 300 feet, less than one-third of the operational depth of other boats of her class. There had also been a frightening incident 3 months earlier when Scorpion had vibrated so violently during high-speed maneuvers that she seemed to corkscrew through the water, sending huge pieces of equipment swaying on their rubber mountings. Rogers and other crewmen feared that the problem could reappear at any time. Most of the submarine fleet had undergone massive safety overhauls after Thresher was lost. The bulk of the work on Scorpion, however, had been postponed due to tight budgets and the relentless pace of intelligence operations, which were growing rapidly toward a peak never before seen during the Cold War. As she set out, Scorpion was one of only four of the Atlantic Fleet's submarines that was still waiting to be refitted with post-Thresher safety features. Rogers and his mates complained to Slattery that he and his officers weren't taking their concerns seriously. Rogers wasn't even released from the boat until he agreed to Slattery's demand that he erase the Cassandra-esque warning of danger from his request for transfer. 1 month later, Scorpion was assigned to join in NATO exercises in the Mediterranean. She was sent there only because the Navy needed a last-minute replacement for Seawolf, the same submarine that Craven had bypassed in favor of Halibut when it came time to pick a special projects boat. Seawolf had knocked herself out of the fleet rotation by ramming an undersea mountain in the Gulf of Maine, badly crushing her stern. The Mediterranean had become the latest Cold War arena. Since the Arab-Israeli War in 1967, the Soviet Union had been sending growing numbers of attack subs armed with nuclear cruise missiles to stalk U.S. aircraft carriers and to try to trail U.S. missile subs roaming from a base in Rota, Spain. U.S. surveillance subs were also watching ports in Egypt, where some of the Soviet vessels stopped. The traffic was so thick that by December the Med saw its first underwater collision between the USS George C. Marshall, SSBN 654, and a Soviet attack sub. Most of the time, however, the problem was simply detecting the Soviet subs. SOSUS listening nets, which helped in other areas of the world, didn't reach into the Med, or for that matter, down the west coast of Europe, a key Soviet route to the area. The Med itself has horrible sonar conditions, with salt water meeting fresh water, warm meeting cold, all of it sending sonar bouncing in unpredictable directions. Besides all that, nobody on the U.S. side really understood how the Soviets operated in the Med, or how many subs they were sending. Indeed, submarine analysts in London and their counterparts in Norfolk, Virginia, were having long analytic arguments about Soviet operations, arguments that went on all the longer because there were so few facts to back them up. On the assumption that sheer numbers would fill in the gap left by expertise, the United States began trying to train its allies' sub-forces, those in southern Europe and the Middle East, in the art of sub-chasing. Scorpion, in fact, was sent to the Med to play rabbit, to be hunted by foreign forces as part of their training. For Scorpion's men, this should have been a plum assignment, one with the rare perk of port stops in sun-sprayed Spain, Italy, and Sicily. But many would have preferred to have stayed on shore with Rogers at least judging from their letters home. We have repaired, replaced, or jury-rigged every piece of equipment, 24-year-old machinist's mate second class, David Burton Stone, wrote to his parents on April 12th. Stone sent his letter 2 months into the trip, just before Scorpion got caught in a dangerous game of chicken with a Soviet destroyer. The incident was typical of operations in the Med. Both sides had taken to harassing the other at sea. When Scorpion surfaced to exchange messages with the USS Cutlass, SS-478, the destroyer raced forward as if to ram the submarine. With a crash seemingly moments away, the Soviet ship backed off. "It did it 3 or 4 times, says Herbert E. Tibbetts, the commanding officer of Cutlass, who watched the incident from his bridge. "I kept sweating, thinking, I hope those guys back it down this time." Reports of that incident and rumors of another mission have left many of the families convinced that the Soviets were the likely cause of Scorpion's destruction. According to the most virulent story, Scorpion supposedly was hit by a Soviet torpedo during a final mission in which she tried to chase a Soviet attack submarine away from a U.S. Polaris boat out in the Atlantic. There was, in fact, a final mission, but it had nothing to do with chasing Soviet attack subs. It began in late April. Scorpion was on her final port visit, this one to Naples, Italy. From there, her men expected to be going home. Instead, they were told they were being sent to monitor strange Soviet activity. U.S. satellites had photographed a group of Soviet surface ships just outside the Med, flying balloons about the size of weather balloons. The Soviet ships had been engaged in this baffling behavior for nearly a month. In the Pacific, the Soviets had been known to launch balloons equipped with electronic sensors in the vicinity of U.S. nuclear tests. Perhaps this was a new application of that spying technique. Figuring that Scorpion was going to pass near the area on her way home anyway, Captain James Bradley, still the Navy's top submarine intelligence officer, ordered the sub to swing by and take a look. Slattery and the other Scorpion officers were distressed. After more than 2 months at sea, the officers wanted to go straight home, and they made that clear at a farewell cocktail party in Naples, cornering Bradley with their concerns. He was sympathetic, but the orders stood. Scorpion set out toward the Soviet ships on April 28th. Slattery stopped outside the breakwater at Rota, Spain, to drop off a crewman and a spook who had become ill, then went on. Scorpion lurked near the Soviet ships for 2 or 3 days before Slattery turned his sub for home. When he reached a safe distance from the Soviets, he radioed a message that he had collected a few photographs, but little insight about the Soviet exercise. "It is not entirely clear where this group of ships was working, but declassified Navy documents cite one possibility. Air reconnaissance planes had spotted 2 Soviet hydrographic survey ships, a submarine rescue ship, and an Echo II-class nuclear attack submarine, conducting an unspecified hydroacoustic operation southwest of the Canary Islands, which lie about 300 miles off northwest Africa. Air reconnaissance was cut off on May 19th and resumed on May 21st, just about the time Scorpion would have left the area. There were no observed changes in the pattern of operations of the Soviet ships, either before or after Scorpion's loss, that were evaluated as indicating involvement or interest in any way, the Navy would later report in a document prepared in 1969 by a court of inquiry into the Scorpion disaster, and kept classified for years. On the evening of May 21st, Scorpion's crew radioed in their location and reported that they had embarked upon their assigned route home, the Great Circle Track through the North Atlantic. Ordered to transit at 18 knots, They said they expected to arrive in Norfolk at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on May 27th. Admiral Thomas Moore, the CNO, and Vice Admiral Arnold F. Shade, commander of submarines in the Atlantic, began to worry when Scorpion failed to answer messages on May 23rd, as well as repeat messages over the next 2 days. They quietly asked a few Navy ships and planes to scan for signs of the submarine. No general alarm was raised. After all, Slattery and his men could be racing home underwater and out of radio contact. Concern turned to fear on May 27th at 12:20 p.m. It was 20 minutes before Scorpion was supposed to arrive at Norfolk. By now, she should have been on the surface, her crew talking with the base. Shade initiated an intensive communications check. Ships and planes flooded the air with Scorpion's call name. Brandywine! 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 There was no answer. At 3:15 p.m., Scorpion was declared missing. Back at the dock, the crewmen's families waited for their husbands, sons, and fathers to come back from the sea, waited in a spring rain that washed the dock clean. They knew nothing about the frantic radio messages tearing through the air around them. Then the Navy told them to go home, told them that Scorpion had been delayed. It was only when news reporters started calling that the families learned that their sons, husbands, and fathers were missing. By the time Craven turned for the Pentagon, intelligence officers had already been frantically scrambling for acoustic evidence or other signs of an accident, a collision, or a battle. Reconnaissance pilots placed all known Soviet and Eastern Bloc surface warships, merchant ships, and submarines at least 50 miles away from any point Scorpion was expected to pass. The Navy would later report that there was no evidence of any Soviet preparations for hostilities or a crisis situation such as would be expected in the event of a premeditated attack on Scorpion. Indeed, by the time Craven walked into the war room, the Navy basically had ruled out Soviet involvement in Scorpion's loss. Vice Admiral Shade set out himself to join the search on the USS Pargo, SSN 650. Rogers, the former crewman, went out looking as well aboard his new submarine, the USS Lapon, SSN 661. There was a moment when everyone on Lapon believed that Scorpion had been found. Lapon's radio men picked up an SOS from Brandywine. But soon it became sickeningly apparent that the message was a fake, a sadistic joke from merchant seamen or pleasure boaters. Meanwhile, Craven launched a search that would take so many twists and leave him so at odds with the rest of the Navy that he himself would begin to wonder whether he had indeed gone mad. He began, routinely enough, thinking of ways to acoustically delve the ocean depths. It was clear that the SOSUS listening nets were going to be useless. While the listening system in the Pacific had picked up that one pop, the only sign of the Soviet Gulf's loss, the extensive SOSUS arrays in the Atlantic could not do the same thing. The Atlantic SOSUS system was designed to filter incoming noise, allowing the sonar nets to record the consistent clatter of machinery, the whir of submarine screws, and all the other music made by submarines as they move underwater, while muffling the blasts of oil exploration, undersea earthquakes, and the calls of whales. That same filtering system would have eliminated any evidence if Scorpion had fallen to the ocean bottom, would have broken apart the terrible cries of a submarine imploding, rendering them nearly indistinct from the normal ocean din. "How the hell are we going to find these poor bastards?" Craven muttered to himself. Within days, he would be named chairman of a technical advisory group convened to help find Scorpion by Robert A. Frosch, the Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Research and Development. Craven and the other group members were to report directly to the CNO and the commander of the Atlantic Fleet. He began calling upon the small oceanographic research stations that dotted the Atlantic. Top on his list was Gordon Hamilton, a friend who ran an oceanographic laboratory in Bermuda that was funded by the Office of Naval Research.
"Hey, Gordon, do you have any hydrophones in the water that could have heard the scorpion?"
Craven asked, without bothering to offer a greeting.
"Well, I don't, but part of my laboratory in the Canary Islands has a hydrophone in the water all the time,"
Hamilton answered. The hydrophones generated mounds of scrawled paper, those peaks and blips that accumulated as pens moved over continuously rotating drums. There was a problem, though. 6 days had passed since Scorpion's last message to shore, and laboratory workers were supposed to clean up and toss the records after 2 or 3 days. Any scrawls that could have registered a final tragedy aboard Scorpion should have gone out with the trash. Still, Craven firmly believed that people rarely do what they are supposed to do. Housekeeping, he reasoned, is usually the first thing to go. Within a couple of hours, Hamilton called back. Craven was right. There were piles of paper all over the lab, and buried within those piles were 2 weeks of acoustic records, including 8 separate ocean explosions or severe disturbances during the 6 days Scorpion had been out of contact. But the disturbances could have been caused by almost anything, including blasts from illegal oil operations, a fairly routine sound ringing through the North Atlantic. And they could have come from almost anywhere, and from any direction. With only one set of records, Craven had no way to come up with a geographic fix on any of the blasts. To do that, he would need to triangulate 3 separate recordings from 3 separate hydrophones set up in 3 different points. Since he didn't have the data to come up with a precise fix, Craven worked backward, charting the times of the explosions against Scorpion's known path and speed. He came up with 8 mid-ocean locations, where he assumed the sub would have been at the time of any of the disturbances. Bathymetric charts showed all 8 sites to be in waters deeper than 2,000 feet, deeper than the crush depth of a submarine. Acting on Craven's data, the Navy sent planes to all 8 spots. The pilots were looking for floating wreckage and oil slicks. They found none. The lack of debris was far from conclusive, given that the water was so deep. But Craven needed more to go on. The hunt for sonic evidence continued. Independent of Craven's efforts, Wilton Hardy, the chief scientist of an elite acoustic team at the Naval Research Laboratory, the Navy's primary underwater testing facility in Washington, D.C., came up with the next clue. He knew that the Air Force kept 2 hydrophones near Newfoundland to track underwater shocks from Soviet nuclear tests. One was right off the peninsula of Argentia. The other was about 200 miles from there. Hardy sent for the records, knowing he was playing a long shot. Both Air Force hydrophones were about as far from the Azores and Scorpion's last known position as any listening devices could be and still be in the North Atlantic. And sitting right between the hydrophones and Scorpion's track was the largest chain of mountains on Earth, the undersea Mid-Atlantic Ridge. The mountains were enough to block most sounds from the Azores. Indeed, at first glance, the Air Force records looked useless. There were none of the dramatic peaks that had been registered by the Canary Islands lab. But to Hardy, it seemed that if he looked real hard, maybe squinted a bit, he could just possibly see something. He laid the Canary Island recordings directly on top of the Argentia recordings. There they were, almost entirely buried in local noise, slight blips that seemed to match the more dramatic peaks picked up by Hamilton's lab. Hardy called Craven, who was by now coordinating the Navy's entire acoustic search effort. Craven decided to convince himself that the Argentia recordings were neither coincidence nor phantoms. If the Argentia blips were worthless noise, then the plots would probably fall hundreds of miles or thousands of miles from the relatively tiny line of ocean that made up Scorpion's track. But if the new data pinpointed any one of the 8 events picked up in the Canary Islands on that tiny line, the acoustic matches would almost certainly have to be valid. Hardy found it first. There, right on Scorpion's track, was an explosion strong enough to tear through a steel hull and send a submarine flooded toward the ocean bottom. There was no telling what caused the explosion, but 91 seconds later, there were a series of much louder blasts, and there was no mistaking what caused those. Craven and Hardy were convinced that they had to be implosions, the agonized shouts of a submarine collapsing in on itself, compartment by compartment, breaking down with the force of nearly 500 pounds of TNT. The men on the submarine could have survived the initial explosion, if that sound was indeed from Scorpion. They might have lived long enough to hear her walls begin to quaver inward, but that would have been all. Nobody could have lived through the first implosion. That shock would have sent the tail section and the bow section plowing into the center of the submarine, like a papier-mâché model crushed in front and in back with a single violent clap. The cataclysmic heat and the shock of that would have killed everyone on board in less than 1/100th of a second. The men would all be dead, even as the ocean pressures continued to pummel Scorpion. A second implosion 4 seconds after the first, then another 5 seconds later, then 2 seconds, then 3 seconds, then 7 seconds, then another, and another, and another. 3 minutes and 10 seconds after the first explosion, it would have been all over. 3 minutes and 10 seconds of destruction before the ocean went suddenly quiet. Recorded only 18 hours after Scorpion's crew had sent word they were heading home, the blasts meant that the sub had managed to travel less than 400 miles toward Norfolk. It was now 4 days after Scorpion had been declared missing. Craven called the chief of naval operations to tell him that Scorpion was probably lost forever. Moore wasn't ready to hear that. He wasn't about to tell the crewmen's families and the nation that there was no hope based on a bunch of tiny, almost indiscernible blips on paper. The fact that they occurred at a point right on Scorpion's track, at a moment when she was expected to be there, was enough to convince him only to declare the spot an area of special interest. Then he waited to see whether any of the planes, ships, and submarines turned up anything else. Rear Admiral Bechany, commander of the submarine force, began funneling all press inquiries to Craven. But the scientist remained under strict orders to avoid the word lost, and even the suggestion of death. It wasn't until another 6 days had passed, with no sign of Scorpion, that Bechany and Moore were forced to accept that Craven and Hardy were right. On June 5th, Moore announced that the Scorpion was presumed lost. Hours later, the Secretary of the Navy formally declared Captain Slattery and his 98 other officers and crewmen legally dead. But Scorpion was still missing. Without examining the remains of the sub, the Navy would never know what had gone wrong. Without that understanding, the nuclear submarine fleet would forever operate with the fear that a fatal flaw, somehow overlooked, could cause another catastrophe. Absent proof the crewmen were dead, their families might never be able to shake the thought, against all logic and against all available information, that the men might have been captured and were alive somewhere, perhaps in a Soviet prison. And so began the second phase of the search. Now it was up to Craven and his team to find Scorpion and to find out what killed her. He turned his attention back to the acoustic echoes. The site of the first explosion, now being called Point Oscar, marked where his search would begin. But that still left him far from finding the sub. Thermal layers in the water could have distorted the sounds of Scorpion's loss as they traveled to the Canary Islands and the Argentia hydrophones. Craven calculated that there could be 10 miles of error for any of the spots mapped by the triangulated data. Also, the water at Point Oscar was 2 miles deep. The Scorpion would have stopped imploding about 7,000 feet before she hit bottom, cutting off the acoustic trail. Depending on how fast she had been traveling and in what direction, and depending on the force of implosion and the position of her stern planes as she fell, she could have been thrown miles further. All that meant that the submarine could be anywhere within a 20-mile-wide circle, leaving a vast, unknown universe to search. And the art of deep-sea search was still in its infancy. In starting the Scorpion search, Craven had far less data than he had when searching for the Soviet Gulf in the Pacific. The Navy decided to send a surface ship to comb the area surrounding Point Oscar. There was no thought of sending halibut on this search. Halibut was a boat designed for secrecy, and there was little need to shroud the fact that the search was going on, since the Soviets could easily read about the missing submarine in American newspapers. Instead, the ship the Navy employed was the USNS Mizar, an oceanographic survey vessel. She was a 266-foot-long former polar supply ship that had been converted to research at the start of the Navy's post-Thresher scramble to the deep. For this mission, she would be under the direction of Hardy's team at the Naval Research Laboratory, where she was based. Mizar carried towed cameras, less advanced versions of halibut's fish, and with those she would start the slow, painstaking survey of the ocean bottom. The search would be led by Chester Buck Buchanan, a civilian oceanographer and senior NRL scientist. As Buchanan set out, he knew he was in for a long haul. Crawling at 2 knots, it would take Mizar months to cover the area. But Buchanan was a tracker by nature. Short, stocky, and good-naturedly pugnacious, he began to grow a beard the day Mizar left port, a Van Dyke, declaring that he would shave only when he found his quarry. Staying in constant contact with Hardy and Craven as they sorted through the acoustic crumbs, Buchanan began directing Mizar in circles over Point Oscar, finding little more than what seemed to be iron-rich meteorites. Following the Navy's lead, Mizar then began scouring the area west of Point Oscar. The Navy reasoned that since Scorpion had been heading west toward Norfolk, that was the best direction to search. Meanwhile, Craven began digging for more evidence, anything that could help direct Mizar from shore. He set about trying to map each implosion in the hope that he could figure out how far Scorpion had traveled before the final sounds of her loss subsided. He found much more. Craven's map showed that Scorpion had not been traveling west toward Norfolk during her final moments. Instead, Craven's calculations surprisingly showed that the submarine had been moving east, back toward the Mediterranean. Perhaps a submarine could turn if it were fleeing from another boat, but intelligence officials had already told Craven that they were all but certain that the Soviets were not involved. It had to be something else. The scientist went straight to Besheny's submarine command. He had one question. What could make a submarine go in the wrong direction? Craven asked the same question of several captains and admirals. Each time he got the same answer. A submarine turns around 180 degrees when a torpedo activates while it is still on board, an event submariners call a hot run. The boat turns because that triggers fail-safe devices on a torpedo, shutting it down. The same safety devices keep the weapons from turning and blowing up the submarines they are fired from. Scorpion carried a load of torpedoes, armed and ready for the worst, as did all Cold War attack submarines. There were 14 Mark 37 torpedoes, 7 Mark 14s, and 2 nuclear-tipped Mark 45 Astor torpedoes. Hot runs were particularly common with the Mark 37s, and if there had been a hot run, Slattery would have called right full rudder, ordering a 180-degree turn the moment the torpedo room reported the problem. Any captain would have. The maneuver is one of those things that are drilled into submariners until the reaction becomes simple reflex. In fact, Scorpion had recovered from a hot run in December 1967, 6 months before she was lost, precisely because Slattery had followed the standard procedure. That had to be it, Craven reasoned. Scorpion was traveling west, and that had to mean that something had gone wrong with one of the sub's torpedoes. Somehow it had activated, and somehow it had exploded. Craven began to dig around. He learned that there was a flaw in the onboard testing equipment that could easily have triggered a hot run. And he learned that torpedoes, along with almost every other piece of equipment on board, are routinely tested as submarines make way for home. One of Craven's favorite maxims was, "If something can be installed backward, it will be." And in this case, it was true. Several submarines have reported hot runs as a result of electric leads on the test equipment being installed backward. The problem had become common enough that the commander of the Atlantic Fleet issued warnings. With that known flaw and the acoustic data, it seemed to Craven that Scorpion's fate had been determined. Scorpion had been battling a hot-running torpedo, probably created when somebody mistakenly reversed the leads during a test. Only her turn to the east had been too late. The logic, the evidence, it all fit. Craven was convinced. There was only one problem. Almost nobody else agreed with him. The sonic experts, the torpedo experts, the submarine commanders, all listened as Craven held forth with his theories, his evidence, and his logic, his voice rising and falling as if offering a Shakespearean soliloquy, albeit one punctuated with his own trademark maxims of the deep sea. But nobody of any rank, from the chief of naval operations on down, thought Craven could be right. Hardy, the acoustic expert at the Naval Research Lab, was convinced that Craven was reading way too much into the acoustic data and was chasing ghosts. The only thing that turned east toward the Med, Hardy believed, was Craven's phantom trail. His arguments instilled some doubts within Craven. Besides, it was Hardy's lab that was guiding the Mizar, and Craven needed his support if the ship was going to turn around and start searching to the east. Craven's own relationship with the lab was shaky. As director of the Deep Submergence Systems Project, he had basically stolen one of the lab's prized possessions, the bathyscaphe, Trieste II, to assist in working out features for Rickover's NR-1 mini-sub. The officers in charge of torpedo safety at the Ordnance Systems Command soon joined the group of naysayers. They insisted that it was impossible for a hot-running torpedo to detonate inside a submarine. For detonation to occur, the command insisted, a warhead would have to run into an object at top speed and stop moving only as it hit. Then, and only then, would it go off. The Ordnance Systems commanders were backed up by the Bureau of Ships. Walter N. Buck Dietzen, Jr., a top submarine official, was also firmly in doubt. As the debate raged on, none of the men forgot that they were looking for their own dead. Still, at one point, in an effort to lighten things up a bit, Dietzen wagered Craven a bottle of Chivas Regal Scotch whiskey that he would turn out to be wrong. Operational commanders were betting with Dietzen, Mizar had already dug up some tantalizing clues on the Norfolk side of Point Oscar.
There were three items found that could have fallen from Scorpion: a piece of elbow pipe, what seemed to be a woman's umbrella, and a rope tied in a monkey's fist, the ball-shaped knot that sailors tie at the end of a mooring line to make it easier to catch when it is tossed onto a pier.
There was some argument within the Navy about whether the monkey's fist Mizar found was tied in the U.S. style or in the style favored by the Italian Navy. But the umbrella, the operations officers believed, had to have come from Scorpion's crew. They had made port stops, hadn't they? This could have been someone's souvenir or gift for a woman back home. Months would pass before Navy biologists declared that what looked like an umbrella was actually alive, one of the many odd creatures that live on the ocean floor. Still, given the Mizar evidence and the strong opinions around him, even Craven began to wonder whether he was wrong, just smoking opium, as he liked to say. But then again, maybe he was the only one who was right. Craven had no trouble believing either possibility, so he kept digging. He arranged to have a ship drop small explosive charges at Point Oscar. By comparing the acoustic signatures taken at the site with the signals that reached Norfolk, he would be able to figure out once and for all whether an explosion in the area would create echoes, sonic ghosts, as others had contended. Gordon Hamilton flew into Norfolk from the Canary Islands for the occasion. The two men camped out in a bare cinder block room in a Norfolk communications station. There they would wait, all day and all night, and all the next day, until the calibration charges rang through to shore. On the first and second tries, the charges were too weak, and none of the acoustic signals made it back to Norfolk at all. By now, Hamilton and Craven were tired of eating cold sandwiches, tired of the bare walls and bare room, tired of sleeping on the blockhouse floor, and more tired of one another. They had exhausted their repertoire of shop talk. Craven had even run out of Maxims of the Sea. Craven began doing push-ups. He had already taken to filling in the time left over from his two submarine searches, the design of the NR-1 and his running of the Sea Lab program, by putting himself through the Royal Canadian Air Force exercise program. By now, he could do 80 push-ups at a set. He proved that several times over before the explosives finally signaled through to Norfolk. They came through with no echoes. And when Craven and Hamilton recalibrated the Scorpion signals with the new data, they realized that not only had Scorpion been traveling east, but she was traveling east even faster than Craven had thought. Craven was back to his torpedo theory, but he wanted more evidence. With typical dramatic flair, Craven arranged a reenactment of the tragedy. He needed a submarine simulator, and he needed Lieutenant Commander Robert R. Fountain, Jr., the former Scorpion XO, who had been detached from the submarine just before she embarked on her final mission. Fountain was put at the simulator's helm, and a computer was programmed to factor in the orders he gave as the simulator reenacted various possible causes of Scorpion's loss. 10 different scenarios were tested this way, and 10 failed to create a match with the acoustic evidence. Then Craven's team asked Fountain to try one last time. They said nothing about a possible torpedo explosion. They simply told Fountain that he was heading home at 18 knots, leaving it to him to choose a depth. Craven then asked him to test his torpedoes. The team waited 10 or 15 minutes, giving Fountain a chance to stand calm. Then they rang an alert. "Hot running torpedo in the torpedo room!" Without missing a beat, without waiting, without asking questions, Fountain ordered, "Right full rudder." There it was, the turn that Craven believed had been executed on Scorpion. When Fountain's simulated turn was almost complete, maybe half a minute or so after he had called out right full rudder. The staff called into the simulator, "Explosion in the forward torpedo room." The same information was fed into the computer, which began to register extensive flooding in the submarine. Fountain answered with a seemingly endless stream of orders. Blow ballast, initiate watertight security, speed the boat. He did everything a submarine captain should do. Still, the mythical submarine continued to flood, and it continued to head toward the bottom. Exactly 90 seconds after Craven announced the explosion, it passed 2,000 feet, passed right through collapse depth, and the computer registered an implosion. Someone on the staff announced the event with one word. Bang. The simulated implosion occurred just 1 second off the 91-second time recorded between Scorpion's explosion at Point Oscar and the first implosion under crushing ocean pressures. Chills shot through Craven when he saw the results. By now, he and several others attending this test were nearly certain they had replicated Scorpion's loss. No one told that to Fountain. No one told him he had just possibly enacted the circumstances that led to the deaths of the men he had once helped to command. Maybe nobody had to tell him. He left the simulator without asking any questions, without saying a word. Craven's compassion for Fountain and for the crew of Scorpion couldn't squelch the exuberance he felt. As a detective, he had come up with 2 new important pieces of evidence, and now he raced them to Admirals Shade and Bernard A. Clary, the Vice Chief of Naval Operations. By now, even they were becoming intrigued by Craven's detective work, but they remained unconvinced, as did the Ordnance Systems Command, which continued to insist that there was no way a torpedo could explode on board a submarine. Nobody was ready to face the specter that the Navy itself was responsible for the deaths of those 99 men. Craven understood their reluctance, understood how difficult it was for the admirals to believe they might have been somehow responsible for a mistake that had caused the loss of so many people's lives. Both admirals had lived through a time when death aboard submarines was common. Both were veterans of the World War II diesel boats. But then death had come from the enemy, and not from their own boats. Shade was probably the more hard-nosed of the two, and no wonder. As a young executive officer on the USS Growler, SS-215, Shade had gotten his first taste of command while his skipper lay wounded on the bridge of the sub. Commander Howard Gilmore shouted a final order to young Shade, an order to take Growler into a desperation dive to escape a Japanese gunboat, while leaving Gilmore wounded up top. Shade did as he was directed. Despite the admiral's reluctance, Craven wasn't about to give up, not now that he was convinced he had enough information to find Scorpion and prove what killed her. He began to mathematically construct a map of the ocean bottom, using Bayes' theorem of subjective probability, the same algebraic formula he had employed during the search for the H-bomb. Few of the officers involved in the search for Scorpion had taken much note of Palomares, and by the time Craven was finished explaining that he was going to use a system of Las Vegas-style bets to factor the value of a hunch into his data, some of the operational commanders were convinced that he had gone completely over the edge. To them, it sounded like he was talking about ESP. Craven once again tried to explain that Bayes seemed to draw on the knowledge that even experts are not always consciously aware they have. The commanders remained highly skeptical. Still, Craven pushed on, asking a group of submarine and salvage experts to bet on the probability of each of the different scenarios being considered to explain Scorpion's loss. To keep the process interesting, and in line with previous wagers, the men bet bottles of Chivas Regal. Scorpion could have glided down to the ocean bottom at speeds between 30 and 60 knots. His submarine experts bet that Scorpion had glided downward at between 40 and 45 knots. Next, the experts were asked to bet on whether they believed Scorpion was trying to shut down a hot-running torpedo and was therefore traveling east. About 60% of the bets favored the torpedo theory. Craven, it seems, was winning some converts. In a third round of betting, the experts picked a glide path. At the most, Scorpion could have moved 7 feet forward for every foot she descended. At the least, she could have nosedived straight down. The bets favored a glide path of about 3 or 4 feet forward for every foot down. That meant Scorpion would have traveled 6 to 8 miles after the first explosion. By the time the bets were finished and Craven sat down to draw a probability map, the calculations had become so complicated that he had to rehire the group of mathematicians who had helped him with the H-bomb. They concluded that Scorpion was east of Point Oscar, 400 miles from the Azores, on the edge of the Sargasso Sea. Years later, the mathematicians would write a book based on their work with Craven, entitled Theory of Optimal Search. The U.S. Coast Guard would adopt the method for search and rescue, and the Navy would use Craven's interpretation of bays to help Egypt clear sunken ordnance from the Suez Canal. But in the Scorpion search, naval officers just shook their heads at Craven's acoustic evidence and his probability map. The scientists may have been convinced that Scorpion lay further east, but the Mizar had found the 3 scraps of debris to the west, and that's where the Navy wanted to keep searching. Weeks passed. Craven waited, trading messages nearly every night with Buchanan. By late August, nothing new had been found, and the jubilation within the Navy that had accompanied the Mizar's find of the supposed umbrella and the monkey's fist knot diminished. By September, all of the likely spots between Point Oscar and Norfolk were almost ruled out. By October, the weather was getting so bad that the Navy decided it would end the search by the end of the month. But Mizar still hadn't really searched east, and it had never searched the site Craven had pinpointed. By now, Buchanan was sporting a fully grown Van Dyke beard and was willing to